Right. Good morning, everybody. We'll bring the Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Quality meeting to order. And our first point of business is to approve the minutes from November 24th.
And Mr. Chair, I believe we have a quorum now.
Yeah, I thought we did. Yes. So if someone would make that motion, I'd sure appreciate it.
I'll move.
I'll second then.
Okay, got a first and a second. With that, all in favor of approving those minutes, say aye.
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 Aye. Those minutes are passed. The next thing on our agenda is a presentation from Jared Trost. If I said your name wrong, sir, I apologize, from the USGS. So if you would like to go ahead and get started, go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I could, please.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I've known Jared for a long time. We worked together at the USGS. And I asked him to come in today for a couple of reasons. We talk at some length about best management practices, about reducing the level of nutrients and pesticides that we apply to agricultural crops, and spend a great deal of time doing that and a great deal of effort. However, we don't always really think about the lag time, the time it will take for those changes to affect themselves in our groundwater systems. So I've asked Jared in to talk about that. This talk primarily is focused on southeastern Minnesota in the bedrock and the complicated and deeper aquifers. So he'll talk about that. The story is a little different in the sand plains and the vulnerable and shallow aquifers, and I think he's going to address that as well. But I just wanted to give some perspective to you about the length of time it takes for best management practice changes to affect themselves in groundwater. And with that, I'll turn this over to Jared Trost.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. Go ahead, Mr. Trost.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jim, Mr. Stark, and thank you for the time today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And as Jim said, my name is Jared Trost. I'm a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Mounds View, Minnesota. And today I'm going to talk about change takes a long time in groundwater. And this is an LCCMR project. Here's the legal citation of the project. And John Niebuhr is on the call today as well. And he is the PI for this project. And so this is one aspect of the larger project. And the project is a collaboration among many folks. You can see those represented on the side here. The University of Minnesota, the USGS, the Minnesota Geological Survey, the Department of Ag, and then the study was funded through the Environment and Natural Trust Fund. So I just wanted to make sure you have a visual to think about groundwater and how long things take. And so many of you probably remember an ad campaign by Heinz Ketchup in the 80s and 90s that the best things come to those who wait. So next time you get a basket of fries, you can think about groundwater and talk about it. So today I'm going to give an introduction about groundwater age, and the tracer method that we use to determine ages in our Southeast Minnesota study. And then I'll touch briefly on groundwater age and water quality trends. And then I'll get more into the Southeast Minnesota study, and then Perham study that was done several years ago, and then talk about conclusions and implications. So first, just to make sure we're all on the same page, in interacting with people, there's different ideas about groundwater, so I want to make sure we're starting from the same place. And so groundwater is basically places below ground where the spaces between rocks or sand grains or whatever the material is filled with water rather than air. And so if you think about your backyard, if you dig a hole in your backyard, that's soil and it's filled with air. But if you are in a groundwater situation, you dig a hole, it'll fill with water. And so it's just places where the void between things is filled with water. And here's just a little schematic. This is a house with a well drilled, and you can see the well goes down into the bedrock, and then there's water filling the space, and then the water flows into the well. And so then the question becomes, what is groundwater age? And that's really what we want to focus on today. And we're not talking about the age of water molecules themselves, because that's really, really old. We're talking about the age that the time elapsed since water first entered groundwater and lost contact with the atmosphere. And so just a few things to highlight on this figure. So here we have the unsaturated zone, which again is where the pore space is filled with air rather than water. We have the water table. So that's really the upper surface of the groundwater system. And then we have here an aquifer. So this is a place that the water flows enough, the groundwater flows enough to support pumping as a water supply. And so again, the groundwater age, the time elapsed since the water reaches this surface and then gets to the point where we're going to pull it out of the system. And, you know, discharge from groundwater could be through a well. It could also be a spring or a river, wherever groundwater is leaving the groundwater system. So the age is the time it takes from entry to the exit. And so if we think about groundwater then, you can see on this figure, there's some faint lines that you can see, and those are flow lines towards this well, okay? And so a single groundwater sample contains a range of ages, a mixture of ages. So if you think about this, these little blue dots just kind of represent how long it takes water to get to different portions of this well. So the top of this well, it might take a year for that water to travel to the well from where it entered the groundwater system. But the deeper portions of the well, it might take 100 years. And so for managing water quality in this well, you can see how that would be a complicated thing because there's this range of ages. And so what we can do when we collect a groundwater sample, we're basically getting a big range of ages. And so this is the fraction of the sample on the y-axis and the age in years before the sample on the x. And I just show this because this line shows that the sample is a mixture of all kinds of different ages. And just similarly, like in the Minnesota legislature, right? It's a single group of people, but you could draw a similar graph saying, what are the ages of the people in this group? And so when we pull a water sample from a well, we're getting a whole range of ages. We envision the water in that well as being many discrete parcels. And when we pull a sample, it's a mixture of parcels of water. And so how can we determine what that age distribution is? And so there are many atmospheric tracers, chemicals that have been used throughout the past. So tritium is a well-known one, and we use that quite extensively for sampling in Minnesota. There's a lot of bomb testing around the World War II era, and that caused tritium to increase in the atmosphere. Other industrial chemicals that make good atmospheric tracers are chlorofluorocarbons and sulfahexafluoride. And they have different histories shown here. Is tritium in precipitation. So you can see in the back in the 1950s and 60s, we had really high tritium, and it's slowly been declining as we haven't been testing bombs in the atmosphere anymore. And there are similar histories for the CFCs and for SF6. So the atmospheric tracers are good because they're in the atmosphere, and water that's in the atmosphere comes in contact with them, and an equilibrium concentration results in the water. And so as these raindrops, they accumulate these chemicals, and then eventually they reach the groundwater system. And after that water reaches groundwater, they're cut off from the atmosphere. And so the concentration in that water is retained then until that water gets to where we collect it or where it discharges. And so you can see, again, that we have atmospheric concentrations in this sample. If this, you know, entered the groundwater system in 1960, it would have a really high concentration of tritium. And a sample that entered in 2020 would have a lot different concentration of tritium. And so just by knowing these well-known tracers with well-known histories, we can then begin to assemble what ages look like using these tracers. And the way that we do that is, I'm just talking about this method today. This is a USGS approach. which builds on lots of work by many people, but kind of assembles it in an easy to use package. So it's something called Tracer LPM, and it's a modeling approach. When we go out and measure concentrations of these tracers in the field, we can then do modeling to come up with age distributions of the samples. There are other methods to do this today, but we're just going to focus on this tracer method today. And so the basic process that we used for our Southeast Minnesota project, step one was we selected the tracers that we were going to use. And so for our study, we used tritium, CFCs, and sulfahexafluoride. Again, they're well-documented tracers, pretty commonly used for studies like this. Step two, we go out and collect samples. And because these are dissolved gases, tritium is not a dissolved gas, but CFCs and SF6, they're pretty sensitive. So it takes, you have to be really careful when you're sampling for these things, and some special equipment is required. Step three, you get those concentrations and you calibrate an age model with sample concentrations using the Tracer LPM program. And then step four, you can predict using the calibrated age models to see what's going to happen with water quality. And really, the goal here is to just understand the timing of when things are going to happen. And so I wanted to mention this too, if you guys are really intrigued by this this conversation and these topics, the USGS has put out a kind of a fun interactive web tool where you can look at change things about your aquifer and just understand what a trend in water quality, how that relates to the age and when a contaminant was applied to the landscape. And so if you just Google USGS GEMACT, it's not a term that just rolls off the tongue. They've come up with a lot better acronyms, but it is memorable. So that's something that you could try on your own at some point. Okay, and today I'll touch on the Southeast Minnesota study and the results that we got from there. So there's some, just wanted to introduce you to kind of the background and the approach that we've used, and now we'll move into the study. So the title of this project is Setting Realistic Nitrate BMP Goals in Southeastern Minnesota. And John Niebuhr, who's on the call, he's the project manager for that. And then again, here's the legal citation for that project. And so Southeastern Minnesota, as Jim mentioned, has some unique geology in the state. It's a karst terrain. And I would use the term driftless, but at our recent meeting, they said that term doesn't necessarily apply. But anyway, it's a unique geologic part of the state, and there are lots of springs. There's a lot of monitoring going on, and there are a lot of confusing trends in water quality that we see, you know, from springs, streams, wells, so on and so forth. And so there's an eagerness to understand what's happening with the water quality and what can we expect. How are things going to change? And so we sampled at four different watersheds, Trout Brook, which is in Meeseville-Ramin Park on the southern edge of Dakota County, and then Crystal Creek is in Fillmore County, and then two different sites in Houston County, Bridge Creek and the Highway 76 spring. And and I'm just going to launch right into the results here. So our calibrated groundwater age summary. So here you can see the red dots, and the red dots represent approximately where in the vertical geology we sampled these springs. And so this is just a generalized representation of the geology of Southeastern Minnesota put together by the Minnesota Geological Survey. And the main take-home message I want to show you here is that the water in these springs, even this spring near the top of the geologic stack, contains a mixture of modern water and pre-modern water. And what I mean by that is, using the tracer method, we can get information, detailed age information, for samples that where water entered the groundwater system after 1953. And that's represented by the red here. The blue is pre-modern, so that is water that we don't have a good ability to date. It's older than 1953. And so we can see that these springs, three out of four of them, are a mixture of datable water and some undatable water because it's older. And so that suggests, you know, if you're thinking about water quality at springs and trends that you see, you may have, you know, it might take 100 years for that that pre-modern water to reach that spring. And that has implications for what we'd expect to see based on what we're doing on the land surface. And so springs are not just recent water. Some of these springs contain some really old water. And then we collected 10 samples from these, the Prairie du Chien and Jordan aquifers. And those are frequently used water supply aquifers. And most of the samples had mean ages of the datable portion between 32 and 42 years old. I'm 43, so that means if I were to dump something on the ground on these sites, it might just be showing up now in some of these wells. And so at this deep part of the system, we're talking about decades. And I think maybe the something interesting to think about is, so the Jordan is used for a water supply aquifer quite a bit, and nitrate levels are generally low. But then the question becomes, are they low because nitrate won't get there, or other chemicals won't get there? Or are they low because it hasn't reached it yet, based on how we've been using the land and how we've been managing the landscape? And so that's, I think, an open question, and I think one that certainly warrants some more thought. And so just to kind of illustrate this in a different way, I'm going to step through a prediction scenario for one of our sites. And so what can the past tell us about the future? And so I will talk about the Highway 76 spring, which is way down here in Houston County, southeastern Minnesota. Here, the age of our modern fraction was 38 years old. And that's just the mean age. I talked about age distributions, and that's just kind of a simple way to say, all right, the average age is 38 years, but there is water older and younger than that 38 years that comes up there. And we were able to date the modern fraction is 85%. So there's some water that is a lot older than 38 years that we couldn't date, but most of the water is in that, around that 38 year mark. Okay, and this is in the Jordan Aquifer. Again, that's a common water supply aquifer in southeastern Minnesota. And so the basic idea behind these simulations is that you have some known contaminant history. So we're going to use alichlor. This is a pesticide that was used quite a bit in the early 1980s. And then we've got our age information from our modeling and from our tracers. And then we can look at how is water quality going to change into the future as we move forward. Okay, so here we've got alichlor sales data, and this data was compiled by Kevin Keener from the Department of Ag, and we're making a big assumption here that the statewide sales data reflect application in southeast Minnesota, and then we have our age distribution from our modeling work and from our samples. And then we can look at what we think might be the trend at the discharge point. So in this case, what is the water quality, the predicted water quality trend at the Highway 76 spring? Okay, and so here I'm just gonna step through this series of slides. And so the simulations indicate that the alichlor ESA concentrations may begin declining about 40 years after peak use. Okay, so here again is the sales data for alichlor. And then this is our simulated peak here based on our age tracer data. And the orange dots, those are samples collected by the Department of Agriculture in their pesticide monitoring program. And so you can see that our predicted trend, the blue line, lines up pretty well with the increasing trend that they see in their field data. And so I think what's startling is that we saw this big increase from 1970 to 1980 in the pesticide use. And now we're seeing an increasing trend from 2010 to 2020. And so it's a huge, I mean, that's 40 years. That's my whole life that it took for that response to happen at this particular spring. And so again, these are deeper systems in southeastern Minnesota, but I think it is just interesting to understand that. And now if we think about nitrate, and I'll show this slide just to kind of get you thinking about things that could potentially happen. Nitrate's a little bit more complicated. The AlloClor ESA is fairly conservative. It gets to that point and things generally don't consume it. Nitrate can be consumed in the environment by different processes through denitrification. If the conditions are right, nitrate will disappear from the system. But in southeastern Minnesota, from our samples, we don't see a lot of evidence for that happening. So nitrate tends to persist. And so again, here is the AlloClor that you've seen already. And then here's the nitrate trend. And this is, again, a statewide trend. But you can see there's been continuing increased nitrogen application on crops throughout history. And so knowing that we had a 40-year response time for the AlloClor, what do you think might be happening with the nitrate? And I'm not going to answer that question, but I did want to just kind of point it out and get you thinking about what might happen. And it takes a long time for things to happen. And a little sneak peek, I guess, there has been increasing nitrate trend in the samples collected between 2010 and 2020. Okay, so that was the deep system of southeastern Minnesota. And I should mention John's, the larger project is getting at questions on a bigger scale. These are just focused on a few samples. But John's project will get that on a little bit bigger scale and answer some other questions related to water quality. So what about shallow aquifers? And I just wanted to highlight a study that was done near Pearl, Minnesota in the late 90s. And this is published. Tim Cowdery is a colleague of mine at the USGS here in Minnesota. And this one, you might have to get closer to your screen. I took this figure out of the report. And so this is near the Otter Tail River. So the Otter Tail River is here. This area here in this figure is like sandy, gravelly material, so aquifer material. And then this area here is glacial till, so that's generally not very hydraulically productive. And so we're just focused on this aquifer material here. And this upper line, that's land surface. And then the water table is right here, this topmost line right here, that's the water table. And the X or the Y axis here is in meters. And so what you can see that maybe a meter below the water table, the average age of the samples collected is about 10 years. And so in this sandy setting, you can see that just below that water table, it still takes a fairly long time to for changes to happen or for water to reach that point. So if you made a change here, if you stopped using a pesticide or implemented a BMP or changed over from annual to perennial crops, for example, you might take about 10 years for you to see that change at this particular well, which is shallow in this sandy setting. There are probably portions of the state where it would happen much more quickly. And if you put a pumping well in here, a major pumping well, you'd probably increase or decrease the time it would take to do that kind of a change if you change the flow system. But generally speaking, under the conditions that were at this system at the time, 10 years. And then you can see that the age increases with depth. And so it's 10 years near the surface, and then it gets older than 50 years towards the base. And you can see that at this discharge point, if you wanted to try to manage the water quality of the Otter Tail River, you can see here that groundwater discharging at the Otter Tail River ranges in 10 to over 50 years. And so you could have a challenge in managing that output at that point, or trying to monitor at that point, trying to understand what's going on up here if you're monitoring only at that outlet, because it's such a broad mixture of ages. Okay, so the implications of all this, patience is required. I put the ketchup bottle back on here to kind of reemphasize that point. But a key thing to understanding groundwater age is really understanding the history of land use and the history of what we've added to the land, because it helps us understand the current trends. I showed that AlloClor data, and that took a lot of work to assemble that data to understand how it was used in the state. And then that then When we have the age information, really helps us understand the current trend and explain what's happening. And so investing in history is a good idea. And then just in terms of the two studies I presented, in southeastern Minnesota, we estimate 3 to 4 decades are required before a major contaminant input change could be observed in commonly used water supply aquifers like the Jordan. And if you think about it, that's about 10 election cycles, and staying focused on something that long, that takes a lot. And in a sandy aquifer near Perham, up to a decade is required to observe a major contaminant input change in that shallow groundwater. And that's about 2.5 election cycles. And so just to put it in a more pragmatic time, 10 years in those terms, I think it helps us think about how we might tackle that. And so I mentioned the larger project for Southeast Minnesota. So what I've described today doesn't really talk about where to make changes on the landscape. It just kind of talks about when we might see those changes. Other modeling approaches would be needed to answer questions of where to make those changes. And John and other folks on our project team are working on those sorts of modeling efforts. And so with that, I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take questions if there's time. And I have another series of slides that kind of steps through more like just visualizing the how age relates to water quality if we wanted to go through that, but I'd be happy to take questions. Mr. Chairman, I think you're on mute.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Drost. I appreciate that. The first question comes from Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Trost. Your election cycle analysis is flawed. Some of us get elected every 2 years, not every 4 years. So I don't know if that means we're aging faster or slower. You have to decide.
I'll clarify that point.
At the end of the last slide you had up regarding southeastern Minnesota, you talked about nitrates. But you didn't put any data on your slide, or did I miss that?
Yeah, right. I didn't do any predictions with that. And it gets more complicated when you've got this old portion of the water. So if all the water is from 1953 or after, it is easier to model, and we have good age information. If there's some fraction of the water that's older than 1953, we don't actually know the age of it. There's not good tracer methods to use for that, and we'd have to do some other modeling. And John Niebuhr's on the call. We have a groundwater flow model, ModFlow. And so with that, you can get a more complete age distribution. So using the tracer method, we're limited in our ability to predict for water that is older than 1953. And so for that reason, I didn't include that here, because you get mixing happening, and our model wouldn't be that accurate for that. So I didn't do simulations, and I didn't show the field data, but the field data have been collected just span the range of 2010 to 2020.
So if I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Well, so you were able to do that for the Alachlor data because there's no background Alachlor, or that's where I'm confused.
Yeah, right. So so we did it, the Alachlor scenario, because all of the Alachlor use fell within our datable range. So 1970 to 2010. And so it's a very concise, it wasn't used before that, and it hasn't been used after that. And the water so we can catch that peak in the water. The nitrate is more complicated because the nitrate use history goes back a lot farther. And we don't necessarily even have good nitrate use history before 1960. Kevin, from the Department of Ag, put together a statewide history up to 1960. But then what happened before that is not well known. And so also, I guess that's another big reason why we didn't simulate that because what I'd be showing on the graph would be coming from an unknown history, because we don't know that nitrate use or the nitrogen use history. And so that is another reason, why I didn't show those predictions here. And really the main purpose of this graph was to just get us thinking about how we're applying nitrate. Like one of the things, so this graph in and of itself is a little bit, it can look dire, but certainly crop use efficiency of nitrate and nitrogen has increased with time. And so there's a lot of steps between that sales data and what we see in the aquifer. And it's a little bit more complicated for nitrogen because of those sorts of things. Like I said, the aliclor, when it reaches groundwater, it basically stays like a tracer and continues to move. Nitrate can change and nitrate can be used by the crops. And like I said, crop use efficiency has increased with time. So we've applied more nitrogen, and how much of that mass is actually reaching the aquifer, that's a whole nother modeling effort. But the purpose of this graph was to get you thinking about those things.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with everything you said. And I think the bottom line here is that nitrates get really complicated really quickly. There's a tendency in the media and in the legislature, honestly, to oversimplify the nitrate question and the application versus impact on groundwater. It's complicated, and it's there's not just one source either. You talked about application, but it's, I apply manure on my farm too, and that's certainly got an impact on nitrates. Thank you for your presentation. Very interesting.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions, I think, pick up a little bit on what Representative Torkelson was asking, is as I look at the data for the nitrogens, you're taking a look at the red line there, and we see that's applied on a statewide basis. During that time frame, one of the questions I have, do we have the information showing that, part of the reason it's going up is because we're applying it on more acres that didn't have it before. And as a result, if you're applying it on more acres and you're doing a better job of applying it, more of it might be being used now than was historically. Would that be one of the things that might also be part of the that makes it so complicated?
Representative Fisher, thank you for the question. So the sales, so this is purely just like statewide input.
Right. And
whether the logic holds that this represents that little corner of the world at the Highway 76 spring, that is an open question. And so, we've certainly taken more acres. And actually, I don't have that graph. That would be something good to add about acres farmed in Minnesota compared to, and so getting a more of a rate question rather than just the raw sales data, nitrogen application rate per acre. Would give us more of a clean picture of what you're suggesting. So yes, that would remove that question from it at least. But again, how it relates to that specific place in southeastern Minnesota, we have statewide data, but it's hard to say. It's hard to get at these questions on that level to see to explain in detail trends at specific springs.
So much. Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, go right ahead, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding right, is the reason it's hard to quantify is because we really don't have the data that is specific to that region for, say, nitrogen. All we have is for the entire state, and it's really hard to figure out how much of that was, how much of that graft is actually for the area around the springs that you're testing. Is that correct?
Representative Fisher, yes. Yes, that's correct.
All right. No, thank you. And thank you for this presentation. It was very informational. I appreciate getting a better understanding of the lag times that can occur from when things are applied to eventually when they show up or make changes in the underlying water system.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. I do not see any further hands up. I will agree with Representative Fisher. This has been very interesting, very informative. Mr. Trost, we really appreciate your presentation, appreciate you being here with us today. So we will move on to the next presentation, Mr. Stark, unless you have anything you want to add.
Mr. Chair, if I could, please.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to thank Jared for the presentation. It was very good and good questions. As we move on, maybe the theme for today is things take time. So you may have read, you know, in the media recently about the impaired waters list, about the fact that we've added hundreds of impairments to that list this year. And you may wonder why that is. We're halfway through the Clean Water Legacy Program. The PCA and others have been working on this for more than a decade now. So why is that list growing? And I wanted just to hear a little bit of, I wanted you to hear a little bit about why that is and what the trends are and why that list continues to grow and what that means. And Paul Gardner from the Clean Water Fund is here, Catherine Neuschler, and Ms. Nichols also are here from the PCA. So they're gonna talk a little bit about Clean Water Fund, about the impaired waters list and why that is growing. So thank you. With that, I'll turn this over to, I'm not sure who's starting here actually.
I'll start. Mr. Chair and members, good morning. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. The Clean Water Council was created as part of the Clean Water Legacy Act in 2006. And the Clean Water Legacy Act governs how we look for and address impairments in our water. The impaired waters list that comes out every 2 years is one way to get an idea of how things are going. We did have a presentation from the PCA at one of the committees for the Clean Water Council a couple of weeks ago. And I have also heard from various stakeholders interested in clean water issues. And I would just say that the numbers initially overwhelm, but at the end, I'm going to offer some comments to help break down those numbers a little bit so they seem a little bit more digestible. And you can see the connections between the number of impairments, the types of impairments, and what the strategies are to address them. That I think, while it doesn't remove the gravity of the situation, it at least allows people not to just freeze up with what I call vapor lock at seeing the top level findings. And if we can break it down, it usually helps. It helps anyway. So I'm going to turn it over to, I believe, Ms. Neuschler from the PCA to go through the content of the report, and then I'll come back for just a minute at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
All right. I am going to share my screen. And hopefully you can all... Oh, are you, like, which version? Are you seeing just a single slide? Or are you seeing multiple slides?
Single slide.
Excellent. Okay. So thanks for having us. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the manager of the water assessment section, and we do many things, one of which is the impaired waters list. With me, along with Paul, is Miranda Nichols, who is our impaired waters list coordinator. I am going to give this is pretty high level, kind of a big picture overview of the impaired waters list, what it is, why we do it, how it's gone over time. And then if there's more detailed questions, we will be happy to answer them. Okay. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about, like, why do we do this? And it's really part of the federal framework and the pathways to clean water. I'm going to talk a little bit about standards, monitoring, and assessment, and then get into the list itself. So basically, you know, to understand the impaired waters list, it's really helpful to understand the Clean Water Act framework. Sorry, I'm having a little problem with my screen here, so I can't see. All right, trying to see if I did not prepare well. There we go. Now I can see what I want to say to you and not just my slides. Sorry about that. So in understanding the impaired waters list, it's really helpful to understand how it fits into the whole framework and oversight for our MPCA water programs that's provided to us by the Clean Water Act. Three of the key components of the Clean Water Act are Section 303C, which is the requirement for water quality standards, Section 303D, which are the requirements for monitoring, assessment, and listing, which is why you may occasionally hear the impaired waters list referred to as the 303D list. And then the last component is Section 402, or point source permitting, which many of you are probably familiar with, but we're not going to talk about today. So the Clean Water Act has sort of two main ways of looking at water and what we need to do to clean it up and keep it clean. One path is a focus on pollution sources using technology or best management practices or other source or facility-based techniques to reduce or eliminate pollutant discharges into water. Again, something many of you are familiar with, but not our focus here today. The other pathway focuses on what's actually happening in the water. And this path starts with the idea of what are we doing to keep the water clean? So it starts with what are we using the water for? How clean does it need to be for us to keep using it in that way? And then the key question for the impaired waters list and follow-up actions, is the water as clean as we need it to be to meet the uses that we want to use the water for? And if not, how do we get it that way? And so both of these pathways lead to various tools for controlling pollution and protecting waters, from permits and compliance tools to our watershed restoration and protection strategies and those local water plans that aim to take actions on the land that improve the water. So that focus on water body condition begins with our water quality standards. Those water quality standards set the overall goal or condition that we want to see in the waters. Although the federal EPA has come up with some suggested standards or criteria, they also call them, it's up to each state to set their own water quality standards. The state decisions then require EPA approval. Again, those standards start with what do we want the water to be clean enough for, which we call the beneficial use, whether that's drinking water, recreation, healthy aquatic communities, fish that are safe to eat, et cetera. And the next step is, well, what conditions are protective? What level of pollution do we need to be under? Or what level of pollution would be bad for the community of aquatic life, or mean you need to limit the amount of fish you eat from that water, or mean there might be levels of algae that would make you just not want to swim in the water? Those standards then are essentially the yardstick that we measure against when we're doing our monitoring and gathering data about the health of our waters. You might consider it like recommended values for our individual health, goals for blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar. Once we get the data on what is in the water and compare it to the water quality standard through that process of assessment, just like your doctor might compare your cholesterol to certain key goals, then we know how things are going. And that information tells us where we need to take action to ensure the health of our waters. And then we can use all the tools we have, the total maximum daily load studies that are the pollution budgets for our waters, permits, other actions on the land and best management practices to get the waters where we need them to be. So monitoring is the key first step in measuring the health of our waters. In Minnesota, as I'm guessing you've heard, we have this watershed-based schedule. Our monitoring staff visit 7 to 8 watersheds each year, allowing us to monitor around the whole state once basically on a 10-year cycle. And the Clean Water Land and Legacy Fund support this intensive monitoring. And Minnesota monitors far more than any other states. Previously to the Clean Water Fund, it would have taken us 100 years to get around the state and to get that information in every watershed. The Clean Water Funds also support fish tissue monitoring for certain kinds of pollutants. So the key value of this monitoring and then the assessment or the evaluation process is that it allows us to really know what is going on with our waters. And of course, Minnesota has a lot of them. We have a lot of lakes. We have a lot of river miles. With our monitoring, we can see where waters are doing really well and where we need to ensure that that high quality is maintained. We can also identify those waters that aren't of good enough quality to support all the uses that Minnesotans want from them. And those are the impaired waters. And so then that we can work to improve and to restore them. So the impaired waters list is required under Section 303D of the Clean Water Act. And we have to update it every 2 years. The list is basically the report out that gathers up all the impairments, puts them together into one list of which waters are not meeting water quality standards. We've kept the list since 1992. And it's really important to remember that it's cumulative. The last list in 2020 represented a really big milestone related to that watershed schedule that I just talked about. It was the first list that represented sort of that cumulative information from one complete pass through all the watersheds in Minnesota. The 2022 list, which is draft and currently on public notice, and Miranda's been hosting a series of public meetings on, is the first list that provides us with information from going back through that set of watersheds on that 10-year cycle. So then what's on the list? As I said, we've kept it since 1992 and it is cumulative. Impairments stay on the list until data confirms that the standards are being met. We may have plans and are already making improvements, but that's not sufficient to take a water off the list. It has to demonstrate that it's meeting water quality standards again. This slide just demonstrates how impairments have increased over time. One thing I wanna highlight is how you can see the impact of the Clean Water Fund and increased monitoring through that first 10-year cycle, been accelerating the number of impairments that we were adding every 2 years. We expect that the additions of impairments, at least for the pollutants that we've monitored over this whole time period, will begin to level off as we make return visits to watersheds. Now, it might not make sense to sound pleased that impairments are going up, and it's really understandable to want to take that overall number and say, well, is that bad or is it good? What does it mean? I think it's really important to remember that knowing the situation, knowing what's going on in the waters is what's really critical. Without that, implementation actions and means to improve things can't be appropriately targeted. To go back to the health analogy, which isn't as fun as the ketchup analogy, if I had blood sugar, but I didn't know it, I'd still be subject to all the same risks of having high blood sugar, but I wouldn't know that I needed to take some actions to try to reduce that and improve my health. And if I was more concerned about a different health problem because I didn't have the data I needed, I might take actions that didn't target or were counterproductive to my main health risks. So that understanding, that baseline knowledge of what's going on in the waters, again, really critical to supporting all our actions to improve things. And it's clear that we can make improvements. This bar chart shows the cumulative numbers of waters taken off the impaired waters list due to restoration actions. We delist more waters than this. We take things off the list for other reasons, but these are the ones that we can tie back to specific restoration actions. And again, I think you can see the impact of the Clean Water Fund. In this case, both the implementation dollars that fund restoration projects and the monitoring dollars that allow us to go back and measure the water quality changes help us see an increase in the number of restorations, which does take time. I think the presentation before this was really applicable here too. It takes time to improve water quality. It's not easy and it takes concerted and specific effort. We would expect these restorations, these impairments that have been fixed and removed from the list, to continue to grow as water quality improvement projects are put in place and we are able to go back and to see the water quality changes. So then just a couple more pictures of what's going on in the water. These maps show the distribution of impairments for some key beneficial uses and helps to show where we need to target projects to improve water quality. The left map shows the percent of streams in Minnesota that are impaired for the aquatic life use, meaning that they don't have the aquatic communities that we'd expect or like to see. This is grouped by our 80 major watersheds. Even if you can't see the numbers, you can see kind of the shading. The blue means few impairments and the red means more impairments. Streams in the north and northeast where land is the least altered are in the best shape. On the right, the distribution of impairments for lakes for the beneficial use of aquatic recreation, boating, swimming, things like that. We have lots of good lakes in Minnesota. Again, in the north and northeast and down to central Minnesota, you see that lots of lakes are meeting goals. Less so in the south, though of course lakes aren't evenly distributed within the state. There's very few lakes in the southeastern parts, so it doesn't take many impairments to have a high percentage. Finally, this pie chart shows the types of impairments that we see. It's important to remember that the ways that we list and put impairments on the list recognizes the multiple different uses that we want every single one of our waters to serve. We don't point to a single river section or lake and say, this is impaired. We can say, well, this part of the river has too much mercury in the fish, so the aquatic consumption use is impaired. That's a single impairment. But the levels of nutrients may be low, so things look good for recreation. The fish communities might be what we expect, so that's good, but the bugs, maybe the bug communities, the macroinvertebrates aren't where we want, so that's a second impairment. So when you look at the total number of 6,168, that isn't water bodies. It's a combination of which water bodies and which impairments. And we do see that some of our impairments, like mercury, which makes up close to 30% of our total impairments, are really driven by pollutants that are national and global in scale. And so it makes sense to try to focus local actions on those impairments that can be really impacted by the local actions. And those actions that we take through our local water plans can impact multiple impairments. Sediment, for example, often transports other pollutants and can smother bug communities. So actions that keep soil on the land can help with multiple impairments, those for sediment, nutrients, and biology. So that's kind of an overview of the list. I think it's really important to remember that listing isn't the only story. It's not the end. It's just one step in that whole larger effort to protect and restore Minnesota's water, which is a collaborative effort between the state agencies, watershed districts, and the local units of government. And at this point, I'm going to turn it back to Paul. Paul, I don't know if you have anything on this slide or you want me to move on to the next one.
Mr. Gardner, before you move forward, I think we have a question for Catherine. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question and I kind of wanted to address it now rather than at the end because it pertained to the slide where we were discussing lake data and some of the data that's being presented as it relates to a decision, whether it be impaired or not. And I have a gripe because over the years, I have noticed a number of scenarios where we would step in, and that would be either the state or other government agencies, and declare that a lake was impaired. And it was frustrating to me because if you had looked very specifically at the testing, you would see in many cases that a lake, river, stream may have had a dramatic 10-year improvement where it was being clearly affected by better policies and better management, or maybe even weather may have played a significant role. Yet experts, quote unquote, would come in and still make a decision and attempt to drive decision-making by declaring that overall that data that we were collecting showed a decline in water quality. And I thought that was really disingenuous. And I hope that we improve the processes to help decision-makers, because just coming in and making that kind of assessment in many of those cases, and I'm very, very clear on a number of those here in my own district, and I think it's easy to make the leap that that's happening in other parts of the state as well, isn't helping those decision makers. Because if you're coming in with a list of impaired lakes that are increasing in water quality, it of course triggers a reaction, and then everybody's reassessing, well, what should we be doing to fix fill in the blank lake, stream, river, when in fact there's been a very clear increase in water quality in the policies and work, boots on the ground, whatever that is, lake associations, watershed districts have made the adjustments that we need. So that's a grain of salt, and then also a question. I'd hope that we're doing a better job when it comes to making those assessments for people that have to make decisions to affect water quality.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Is there a response to his question or comments?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman. I think the communication, absolutely, I hear you, and I can understand that if you've been working on one thing and you get kind of a different message, it can be super demoralizing. I would say we work, Miranda and the team that works on assessments have a very long process built out that involves working with local partners, who join us in what they call a professional judgment group to look at the data when we've been in those waters. And so we do do that work with the local partners to make sure everybody's looking at the data in the same way. And I think, you know, maybe it's hard to know without exact examples of what you're talking about, but I think it's this whole things may be going really well in some place, some pollutants, some beneficial uses, and less so in other ones. And I think that is a communication thing that we need to continue to work on to say, you know, great things are happening here. Maybe there's some other areas where there's something not going so well. Like I said, impairment isn't just this whole water body is impaired. It's got those different elements to it. And sometimes that's a difficult message to try to communicate.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you. My follow-up to that would just be that decision makers aren't always legislators. A lot of times they're lake associations. A lot of times they're, on top of the soil and water conservation districts, but watershed districts. And I'll just use my own example as being a former watershed district manager. We would have groups that we hired to do water testing come in, and it was unfortunate, but there was, of course, work and other efforts, and in other words, money that would follow a declaration of impairment. And unfortunately, that incentivized some to look at those long-term trends and provide their expertise suggesting that we were facing some kind of a crisis, when in fact our efforts in our community had actually caused 10-year or longer trends of improvement. I hope that these processes can be improved to reflect reality, because in many cases it's working, but we're incentivizing organizations, that would be not NGOs, and even in some cases units of government, to skew the data to make a presentation declaring that there's some kind of impairment that deserves X fill in the blank project. And of course it's very expensive and includes all kinds of activities. We'd be much better served targeting those dollars where they're really needed. And I'm glad that you're suggesting that there's a group that looks at this and hopefully uses that magnifying glass to determine what is and isn't impaired and where we really need to put resources. But I can tell you, and there's many scenarios I could cite, but it's not as efficient as I think that we would be led to believe. And so people need to be looking at that. You're in a position to do that. And so, people are, of course, listening along today, I hope, and taking notes. And that's something that should be looked at more closely by any of our agencies that are working on impaired waters lists, is making sure that we're using good rational processes rather than incentivizing negative outcomes because it attracts dollars.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. I think at this point, we'll move forward to Paul Gardner. Mr. Gardner, if you'd like to take over or...
Sure.
Yeah, go right ahead, Paul.
And Mr. Chair, I just have maybe 2 minutes here, and I'm not sure who's got control now, but if you could just flip down to the last slide. There we go. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, as I mentioned before, a committee of the Clean Water Council heard the Impaired Waters Report, and the draft was released publicly, and I just sort of follow social media to see reactions. And we do sort of have this collective statewide gasp when the number comes out. And so the Clean Water Council, particularly the citizen appointees, like to ask lots of questions, as you do. And that really helped us figure out that there are some ways to digest these numbers a little bit so that we can connect them to the strategic activities that the state is carrying out to address them. As with any big problem, it helps to break things down. And Ms. Neuschler pointed out very skillfully that the number of impairments is starting to level off. If you took out the two new types of impairments that were added this time around and compared 2022's report with 2020, you'd probably see an even flatter leveling off. But generally, Minnesota has been monitoring for more contaminants in more places than other states. So it follows that we're going to find impairments in more places. So our numbers tend to suggest that Minnesota is somehow a toxic stew of water. I saw an article in the Minnesota Journal Sentinel recently about Wisconsin's lakes based on their impaired waters work. And they said that 80% of their lakes are healthy. But I would suggest that if they had as comprehensive a monitored network as we do, that the story would be very different. So the impairments were there. We just were able to detect them. Ms. Neutral also pointed out that because of the Clean Water Fund, we were able to test more and do it on a 10-year cycle, so 7 to 8 watersheds per year out of the 80 watersheds that we have. So we're doing roughly 10% more monitoring each year, and it would follow that you'd see a parallel line in the number of impairments, and that seems to have been borne out by the data. If you remember that pie chart, which showed the types of impairments, there's roughly 30% of impairments that we can't really do much about. Mercury makes up 27% of our impairments. It's actually the number one impairment on the impaired waters list. And that at least 90% of that comes from airborne sources that come from outside the state of Minnesota. The number of coal-burning power plants outside Minnesota has gone down, and so the amount of emissions there has actually gone down. But we're still finding the mercury in our lakes. So there isn't really a whole lot we can do either with the Clean Water Fund or the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund or the Outdoor Heritage Trust Fund or the Outdoor Heritage Fund. For the remaining 70% of those impairments, we actually have a systematic way to address those. The biggest chunks there are things like bacteria, nutrients, total suspended solids. Those are the kinds of projects that all of our state agencies and local partners and the University of Minnesota are getting after. But it does take sometimes a decade or more to be able to get those things off the list once they're addressed. But it does, the impaired waters list also, along with all the other planning supported by the Clean Water Fund, allows us to prioritize where to focus on impairments. We probably won't be able to address every single one of them through the tenure of the Clean Water Fund, but we're able to prioritize the ones that can do things like feed into recreational lakes or that are in the drinking water supply management areas, such as the ones that Representative Poston and Senator Weaker saw on our field tour in the Southwest. The other positive sign, again, there's plenty of grave data here, but some good news here is the number of delisted impairments is starting to accelerate. And this is something we expect to go up even more 2 years from now as a lot of restoration and protection projects pay off dividends. But as Ms. Neusser pointed out, it does take time. It's not something where you can flip a switch. You have to engage a lot of local partners and landowners, find willing landowners, and employ best practices and the like. I've learned more about culverts in the last 2 years than I ever thought possible, and what impact they have on water quality. We actually could knock out quite a few impairments if we were able to snap our fingers and change the design of many culverts that go under local roads. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to end it there and let you know that the citizen members of the Clean Water Council are asking a lot of the same types of questions. I certainly will, Representative Heinzman is on the council as well, and I certainly will bring back to our committees his question about incentives and the like that I think is an important thing to think about. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. I do not see any hands right now with questions, but I do want to just mention something to you. Representative Heitzman and I share the Gull Lake chain, and we have a great lake association that's doing really good work. And we have a group that has created what they call a Lake Stewards Program. And currently, that Lake Stewards Program, I believe there's over 100 properties on the chain now that are doing these best practices. It's making a difference on one of our impaired lakes that is on the chain. And other chains, other lakes, associations are starting to use their program. And I would love, and I think Representative Heintzman would as well, love to get them in front of the Clean Water Council to talk about what they do and how they do it, because it's really effective. Every time we add a Lake Stewart, our chain gets better. And our businesses are doing it, and homeowners are doing it, and it's making a really significant difference. So if you can get us on the agenda at some point in time, I'd sure appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And you've mentioned that before, and we do have you on the list on 2022. Okay. I'm actually a Minnesota water steward through my watershed district here in Ramsey County. And I don't live on the lake, but I live near the lake.
Yeah.
And I like your phrase, the more people who participate as stewards, the better things get.
Yeah.
I would say that one complaint we do get a lot on the council is that the number of impairments isn't currently going down, and yet we know that there is progress being made in hundreds of places. And to be honest, we would love to be able to take things off the list because things are improving, but they are, you know, there's a line that you have to cross with two data sets before we can do that. And we have to submit that list to the EPA also for approval. So we find that though we're making good progress with many observers doesn't cut it. And so I'd like to be able to say that it's even better than it looks. So
appreciate it, Mr. Gardner. It looks like Mr. Stark, you have a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, thank you. So I think we can appreciate that this whole process of impaired waters and changes to improve them are very complicated. Paul and I actually started this conversation about this presentation, wondering if there would be a clear and simple and concise kind of message that you could use with your constituents. So to try to explain the complexities in a way that's simple to them, and maybe something to think about over the next month and discuss. But if there's a fact sheet, a paper, or something that you could use and hand out to your constituents, that would be very interesting for us to try to work on. So to try to explain the complexities in a way that people understand and see the progress that's being made.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. I agree. I do not see any further hands. So thank you, folks, for the presentation. And Mr. Stark, I think we'll move on to the legislative agenda. And that if you'll take that ball and run with it, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Catherine, if you could bring the presentation back up and move it downward. Catherine, can you go to the next several slides?
Oh, sure. Sorry, I didn't know what you meant by downward.
Yeah, keep going. Okay, so really quickly, I just want to talk a bit about the recommendations again. So we started out with 50 of recommendations for topics for legislation, which we reviewed, evaluated. At our November meeting, the subcommittee approved by consensus moving forward with 13 of those. And we have bills drafted for those. And what we really need now is input about member support for those specific issues, in particular, which of those bills you would support. So next, please. I'll just very briefly go through these. There are 13 of them. One of them is about a process for voluntary private well testing by a nonprofit, a little support for that. The second is about water safety plans for cities and appropriation for a pilot. The third is reactivation of the Legislative Water Commission and the Water Advisory Council. The fourth is ensuring that everyone has drinking water free from lead. Next, please. Then identifying vulnerable aquifers, a coordinated process to look at the monitoring that's being done around the state. Defining sustainable groundwater limits using some new technology that's been available now through the Minnesota Geological Survey and the DNR. A soil health action plan and then a process to look at how we can preserve rather than restore high quality lakes in the Upper Mississippi River Basin. Next. Finally, the group is the final group is research and outreach regarding precision agriculture, a tax credit for private riparian bufferlands, policy and an appropriation to encourage groundwater recharge where it's needed, a program to keep water on the land, increase water retention, and then a process to change the general fund appropriation limit for watershed districts. Next, please. So I don't know if we can have any further discussion about these bills. You did approve them moving forward at our last meeting. The bill titles have been sent to the members in an email today. So I would really appreciate, for those of you who haven't, you're just responding to that email and letting me know which one of those bills and how many of those bills you support. So that email is in your inbox today. I've already heard from some of you, those people are just copied on that email. But if you could just respond just very briefly with your level of support for those bills by number based on that email this morning, that would be really helpful. So I don't know if we have any discussion about the process, Mr. Chair, or anything else we want to talk about those bills, but this would be a great time.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. I agree. If you could all respond to that list as to whether you'd like to be an author or a co-author, we would appreciate that. And if you would copy myself and Senator Eaton on your response, we would appreciate that also. Mr. Stark, do we have any testifiers today?
Mr. Chairman, no, we do not. So with that, unless there's something from the members here, I think that's the end of our agenda. I want to thank the speakers. That was very informative. I think those two presentations fit together really well. So
yeah.
It's all about time. So with that, unless there are any other comments, thank you and happy holidays to all of you.
Yeah. Thank you everybody for attending. Thank you to all the presenters. And I hope all of you and your families have a Merry, Merry Christmas. We're adjourned.
Thank you.